Imagine raising nearly $32 million, completely dominating the national media conversation, having, almost 14 million followers, hanging on your every word, and still being mathematically doomed to lose a presidential race before a single vote is actually cast.
I mean, it sounds impossible on paper.
Right.
But when you start looking at the structural math of a national campaign, well, those massive numbers can actually create a very dangerous illusion of viability.
You know, it's like when you look at a massive gleaming skyscraper, you really only see the glass and the steel.
Right, it catches the light.
Exactly, it dominates the skyline. You don't see the thousands of tons of concrete poured deep underground just to keep the whole thing from tipping over in the wind.
Yeah, that foundation is everything.
Right, and if someone looks at a beautiful, sturdy, three-story house and says, hey, let's just add 80 more floors to this, well, they are going to have a complete disaster on their hands.
Because scale changes everything. I mean, you would have to completely rip out and rebuild the foundation from scratch.
Yep.
Or the entire structure just collapses under its own new weight.
Which brings us perfectly into the high-stakes world of presidential politics. Welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
So today is Tuesday, August 25, 2026, and we are looking at a brand new, just incredibly comprehensive strategy document published by the American newspaper and American TV.
Yeah, it's a massive report.
It really is. We are analyzing a systematic breakdown of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's potential 2028 presidential campaign. And just to be clear up front, she hasn't declared a campaign yet.
Right, no official announcement.
But in recent interviews with the AP and Reuters, she notably hasn't ruled it out either, so it's definitely in the ether.
Oh, absolutely. And our mission today is to deconstruct the mechanics of what it actually takes to scale a grassroots political movement into a realistic, competitive national presidential bid.
Right, moving from that three-story house to the skyscraper.
Exactly. We are stripping away all the television noise to look strictly at the raw data, the unforgiving math, and, the structural hurdles involved.
Yeah.
And before we dive into those numbers, a quick reality check for you listening. This source material pulls from across the entire political spectrum, and the topics get heavily heated.
Very heated.
Yeah. Both left-wing and right-wing viewpoints are analyzed here. So our job today isn't to take a side.
No, not at all.
And we are absolutely not endorsing anyone's political platform, candidacy, or policies mentioned today.
Right. We need to be very clear about that.
Our only goal is to impartially report on the factual evidence, the polling, and the analytical scenarios presented in the source material. We just want to help you understand the mechanics of this potential campaign.
Yeah, we are treating this document purely as an organizational blueprint. We're looking at how a war room views data versus the narrative you see on cable news.
So whether you are a hardcore political junkie or you're just fascinated by like large-scale organizational strategy, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because before anyone can run for president, they need capital and they need a platform. The document starts by looking at how AOC has transformed from that famous 2018 primary upset into a modern fundraising juggernaut.
It's been quite the evolution.
It really has. And it points out she holds a really unique position in the Democratic Party right now in the 119th Congress.
Yeah, she is navigating a very delicate dual identity right now. I mean, she's currently serving on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is a major legislative hub.
Right, lots of power there.
Exactly. But the detail that really signals her evolving status is that House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries selected her to co-convene the caucus's Cost of Living Healthcare Working Group.
Oh, wow. Which, seems like a major shift.
It is.
That is a very traditional establishment leadership-oriented role for someone who built her brand as an outsider.
Well, the report actually coins a great term for this. They call it institutionalized insurgency.
Institutionalized insurgency. I like that.
Yeah. She is attempting to do two contradictory things at once. On the outside, she maintains a fierce democratic socialist brand.
Right. The progressive champion.
Right. She keeps strong ties to outside progressive movements like the Working Families Party, varying levels of support from the DSA, and powerful independent unions.
Okay, so that's the outside game.
Yes. But on the inside, she is whipping votes and handling mainstream House leadership tasks. I mean, she is basically trying to prove she can be an activist on Friday and a pragmatic legislator on Tuesday.
And the financial metrics backing that operation are just staggering. The report shows that between January 2025 and June 30, 2026, her House committee pulled in $32.61 million in receipts.
It's a massive haul.
Astoundingly, 31.96 million of that came from individual contributions. $0 from corporate cakes, with an average donation of about $16.81.
Yeah, under $17.
Looking at those numbers, it reminds me of a massive successful tech startup built entirely on micro-subscriptions. You know, it's a volume business.
And that volume gives her an incredible degree of independence.
It does. But, well, let me push back on the broader implications of that. Okay, go ahead. If she has nearly $32 million in grassroots cash sitting in the bank from $16 donations, does a candidate even need the traditional establishment donor ecosystem to run for president anymore?
I see where you're going with this.
Like, if you have the micro-subscriptions, who needs the venture capitalists?
Well, here is where we hit that skyscraper foundation problem we talked about earlier.
Okay, lay it on me.
$32 million is an absolutely dominant war chest for a localized house race. But the scale constraint of a national run changes the math entirely.
How so?
Well, the strategy document references the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign as the gold standard for this specific type of small-dollar fundraising.
Right, he basically invented that model.
Exactly. And that campaign raised $218.86 million.
Wait, $218 million?
Yeah, $218.86 million.
Okay, that is a completely different stratosphere. Over $200 million.
And you have to understand why the price tag jumps so violently. A national 50-state presidential campaign isn't just buying more television ads.
Right. It's not just scaling up the marketing.
No, it requires massive specialized infrastructure. You need armies of compliance lawyers to figure out the ballot access laws in all 50 separate states.
Which are all completely different, right?
Oh, totally different. And many of which are specifically designed to keep challengers off the ballot.
Wow. Okay.
You need data infrastructure, advanced teams to set up events in different time zones simultaneously, and, you know, human resource departments for thousands of field workers.
So it's literally building a national corporation overnight.
Basically, yeah. You have to multiply your donor acquisition drastically while funding a nationwide corporate-level infrastructure that a house race simply doesn't require.
So the startup cash is a great starting point, but it's totally useless if you don't have the logistical foundation to deploy it.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the next massive hurdle in the report, which is the brand new DNC primary calendar.
Oh, this is huge.
Yeah. The strategy document makes it clear that all this money only matters if it translates to votes in the exact right order. And we are no longer starting in Iowa.
Right. This calendar shift is a structural earthquake for campaign strategy.
Break down the new timeline for us.
So the finalized DNC 2028 early window begins with South Carolina on January 22.
Okay. South Carolina first.
Right. That is followed by Nevada on February 1st, New Hampshire on February 8th, New Mexico on February 15th.
Wow, rapid fire.
Yeah, and then Michigan on February 22 and Virginia on February 29.
That is brutal. I was looking at the early polling snapshots heading into that gauntlet, specifically an Emerson poll from July 2026.
What did that show?
Well, it puts AOC at 12.5% nationally. That has her trailing Pete Buttigieg at 18.8% and Gavin Newsom at 16.9%.
So she's in the mix but trailing.
Yeah. Now, a different July UNH poll shows her up at 18% in New Hampshire.
Which is strong.
It is, but as you just laid out, New Hampshire isn't first anymore. South Carolina is the real test.
And South Carolina requires an entirely different campaign mechanism than Iowa or New Hampshire.
How do you mean?
Well, in the old Iowa caucus model, a candidate could rely on a rural, heavily white, purely activist base.
Right, a small group of really dedicated people.
Exactly. A small group of highly motivated people standing in a high school gym could generate early national momentum.
But South Carolina isn't a caucus.
No, South Carolina is a massive, high turnout primary. To survive it, AOC would have to immediately prove she has dominant support among older Black voters, and established institutional church and civic networks.
You know, it's like the primary calendar has been redesigned as a political decathlon.
That's a great way to put it.
You can't just be an Olympic sprinter who specializes in one demographic. South Carolina tests one specific muscle group, right? Older, moderate Black voters and institutional networks.
Yes.
Then, just 10 days later, Nevada tests a totally different muscle, which is Latino voters and hospitality service unions.
Right.
Then New Hampshire tests retail politics.
Actually, let's unpack that term retail politics for a moment, because the contrast is vital for you listening.
Go for it.
Retail politics means physically shaking hands in diners, walking in local parades, holding small town halls. It's cheap, face-to-face campaigning.
Very grassroots.
Yeah. But by the time this new calendar hits Michigan and Virginia, it's testing suburban, college-educated voters across massive, expensive media markets.
Where you can't just shake everyone's hand.
Exactly. You have to buy millions of dollars in television time.
Okay, so how does a campaign war room view this new timeline?
What's fascinating here is they view it as an immediate, ruthless filter for coalition breath.
A filter.
Yeah. Under the old system, an insurgent candidate could build momentum in a favorable cheap state and ride a wave of free media coverage.
Like Bernie in 2016.
Right. Now, if a candidate stumbles in South Carolina, they might not literally survive financially to see the states later in the calendar where they have a natural demographic advantage.
Wow.
The strategy document points out that you have to prove you are a broad coalition candidate on day one, or the donor money dries up by day 10.
But let's say she pulls it off. Let's say she survives that primary decathlon and wins the nomination.
Okay, assuming she makes it through.
The prize for surviving that brutal Democratic primary is stepping out of the frying pan and directly into the fire of the general election.
Yes, the general election wall.
We move from how she performs against fellow Democrats to the rigid, unforgiving math of the Electoral College against a Republican nominee.
And this is where the strategy document shifts heavily into spatial arithmetic.
I found the hypothetical matchups in the August 2026 Emerson polling fascinating.
They really are.
Yeah. They show AOC trailing J.D. Vance 43.6% to 45.8% and trailing Marco Rubio 42.9% to 47.7%.
Close, but definitely behind.
Right. Now, to you listening, remember these are very early snapshots. There are still about 9 to 11% of voters undecided here, so these aren't win probabilities.
No, just early barometers.
But it sets the stage for the 270-vote arithmetic using the 2024 map as a baseline.
Right, because the structural reality of the Electoral College means the playing field is incredibly small.
It's very small.
The document outlines a pathway it calls blue wall restoration.
Blue wall restoration. Walk us through the math on that.
Well, if you take the 226 electoral votes Kamala Harris secured in 2024 as a foundational baseline, a Democratic nominee must win Pennsylvania's 19 votes, Michigan's 15, and Wisconsin's 10.
And that gets you to exactly 270.
Exactly 270. There is zero room for error.
Wow.
If a candidate loses just one of those blue wall states, they have to pivot to a Sun Belt substitution strategy.
Meaning what, practically?
That means suddenly needing to win a state like Arizona or North Carolina just to make up the missing map.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. Let's zero in on that hypothetical AOC versus J.D. Vance matchup in those specific battleground states.
Yeah.
Both of these political figures claim the mantle of populism. They both constantly rail against corporate elites and Wall Street.
Yeah, very anti-establishment rhetoric.
Right, but they are operating from completely opposite ends of the ideological spectrum.
Exactly.
Wouldn't a race between those two just completely scramble the traditional political map?
I agree entirely. It would fundamentally alter the axis of contest.
The axis of contest.
Yeah, it wouldn't be your standard Democrat versus Republican race focused on, you know, marginal tax rates or standard policy debates.
Right. It wouldn't be Romney versus Obama.
No.
No.
It would be a vicious clash over the very definition of working class populism.
Let's put that on the ground then. How does that actually play out mechanically in a place like Michigan or Pennsylvania?
Well, it gets messy.
Because they are fighting for some of the exact same voters, but speaking entirely different languages.
Right. So the causal mechanism on the ground looks like this. Vance's strategy relies on telling a factory worker in Michigan that AOC wants to outlaw their gas-powered truck, shut down their local energy plant, and export their cultural values.
Okay, so hitting the cultural angle hard.
Exactly. His goal is to frame her not as an economic populist, but as a cultural metropolitan socialist.
And how does she counter that?
AOC has to counter that by essentially ignoring the cultural bait. She has to prove to that exact same factory worker that her policies will actually double their union strike fund, lower their rent, and penalize their corporate bosses.
So making it strictly about the wallet.
Yes. She has to relentlessly force the race to be about household economics, while Vance forces it to be about cultural geography.
And to win those tight battleground states, she would have to utilize her biggest unique asset, which is her digital reach.
Her digital reach is massive.
Right. But at the same time, she has to solve her biggest vulnerability, which is that ideological branding we just talked about.
It's a tough needle to thread.
Let's look at the digital footprint, because the scale is just absurd. As of August 2026, Third-party trackers put her at 9.7 million Instagram followers and 4.1 million TikTok followers.
It is a phenomenal top-of-funnel audience, no doubt about it.
Huge.
But the strategy document dedicates a lot of space to the conversion problem.
The conversion problem.
Yeah, it references Pew Research data looking all the way back to Barack Obama in 2008.
Which was really the first truly digitally dominant campaign, right?
Exactly. And the historical lesson there is that digital engagement is completely meaningless unless it is tied to a hard CRM database.
Wait, I have to push back on this skepticism.
Okay, let's hear it.
If you have almost 14 million followers across two platforms, isn't that inherently a massive, insurmountable head start? I mean, 14 million people is more than the entire population of the state of Pennsylvania.
It sounds like an automatic win, I'll give you that.
Mm-hmm.
But it falls directly into the likes equal votes fallacy.
Okay, explain that.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, social media provides incredible reach, but a political campaign requires physical conversion.
Right.
Those 14 million followers are a very messy data set. They include teenagers who legally aren't old enough to vote.
Fair point.
They include international followers who don't live in the U.S. They include political opponents who just follow the account to monitor her. And crucially, they include low propensity voters.
Meaning people who, like, enjoy the aesthetic of politics, but don't actually participate in the mechanics of it?
Precisely. A low propensity voter will watch a 5-minute video on TikTok, but they will not stand in line in the freezing rain in Detroit in February to cast a ballot.
Yeah, that's a very different level of commitment.
And you cannot knock on an Instagram follower's door if you don't have their physical address.
Right.
So a CRM database, customer relationship management, means taking that digital enthusiasm and systematically matching it to a registered voter file.
Getting real data.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It means getting a phone number, assigning that person to a local field office, and giving them offline volunteer assignments.
Which is incredibly expensive and, frankly, unglamorous work.
It is grueling. Digital virality is free. Physical organizing costs millions.
Which brings us to the central strategic dilemma of this entire potential campaign, something the report labels progressive authenticity versus national governing credibility.
This is the crux of the whole thing.
Right. To win a general election and convert those moderate battleground voters we talked about, she would have to reposition herself toward a governing emphasis.
Move away from just being the insurgent.
Yeah. The report notes she'd need to highlight the nuts and bolts of her job. Things like her bipartisan geothermal legislation or, you know, the hard logistical implementation of public housing bills.
She has to prove she can manage the heavy machinery of the federal government, not just critique it from the outside.
But, and here's the catch, she has to do that without demobilizing the highly engaged, deeply ideological activist base that literally funds her campaign with those $16 donations.
It's a paradox.
And she has to execute this pivot while Republican attack themes are already completely baked into the electorate's mind. I mean, the opposition ads practically write themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
Her initial drafts of the Green New Deal, the socialist label, her stance on Gaza, the New York Squad caricature, it's all just waiting there.
The campaign would have to execute a flawless tightrope walk of validation.
Validation meaning what?
Well, to prove her executive competence to moderates in Wisconsin, say, she would desperately need mainstream validators. We're talking about moderate mayors, military veterans, and pragmatic union leaders standing behind her at a podium saying she is a serious executive leader.
But if she pivots too hard to the center to win over those mainstream validators, she risks alienating the grassroots energy that makes her a political powerhouse in the first place.
And the mechanism of failure there is extremely swift.
How fast does it fall apart?
If the progressive grassroots feel she has watered down her message to appease the establishment, the $16 micro-donations dry up overnight.
Wow.
The digital volunteer army goes quiet. And suddenly, the foundation of that massive skyscraper begins to crack under the weight of a 50-state campaign.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've just spent this deep dive ripping through a massive organizational and strategic blueprint from the American newspaper and American TV.
It's a lot of data to process.
It is. And what emerges is a delicate, almost microscopic balancing act.
Very delicate.
A candidate in this lane has to harness record-breaking grassroots funding, systematically translate that into a physical ground game, survive a brutal new primary calendar that tests coalition breadth from day one, and somehow expand a fierce insurgent brand into a 270 electoral vote governing coalition.
Yeah, understanding these exact mechanics should make you a much sharper consumer of political news going forward.
Absolutely.
The next time you see a political story dominating your feed, you now know to look past the viral debate clips and the social media follower counts. You know, to watch the structural data.
You know what questions to ask.
Exactly. You should be asking, are there small dollar donors retaining month over month? Are they building a physical ground game to survive South Carolina? Are they hitting mathematical viability thresholds state by state?
You're looking at the concrete foundation now, not just the glass and steel catching the light on top. And that leaves us with a final fascinating question for you to mull over. We've just spent this time looking at how a progressive insurgent would structurally have to moderate and broaden her coalition just to survive the DNC calendar and the brutal math of the Electoral College.
Yeah.
Given the strict arithmetic of these specific battleground states and the way primary calendars are ordered, is the American political system engineered in a way that makes it mathematically impossible for any true ideological insurgent, whether on the left or the right, to win the modern presidency without fundamentally watering down the very identity that made them popular in the first place?
It's a great question.
Think about that the next time you see a political skyscraper being built. We'll see you next time.